I'm just going to welcome David, and thank you, David, for coming along. You had a pretty hectic set schedule. I was communicating with him, and you've been in Tasmania, haven't you? And I'm not going to introduce him, because part of what he's talking about is going to be his introduction himself, so I don't want to steal any of his thunder. But before we do, I'm just going to pray for David before he speaks. Okay. Lord, we thank you for David, the work he's doing with the refugees, asylum seekers. We pray that you will continue to bless his work. We thank you for the way that he has gives his energy to this. And we commit him to you now as he speaks to us about what he's doing and how he's doing it in to serve you. And we commit him to you now. Amen.
Thanks very much for having me here, Bill. We did have a pre-meeting some months ago when I was going to be coming early. We had a coffee down at Forest Hill, if I remember rightly. And when Bill came back from holidays, I was running out of time to do it again, so that hasn't happened. I want to give a bit of background to myself, and then there's some time for questions there. Then I'll talk about the Asylum Seeker Centre, and there'll be time for questions as well. I found that doing it that way, that each group I speak to is different, so there's not much point in doing a potted Asylum Seekers talk, because some people know half it and others want to know something different. So just background for me is my home church is St Barnabas Anglican Church, Glen Waverley. So St Barnabas comprised of three churches. St Andrew's, Glen Waverley was one. St James, Sindel was a second one, and St Paul's, Glen Waverley, the third. The three churches were sold to three churches, and we built on a new site which is next to the water reservoir in Glen Waverley. So going back a few years, just to link into that, Phil Saunders was our vicar and Graham Sells was your vicar here, if you can think back that far. And we came here to a breakfast and we, as a part of a church growth seminar, which we ran from St Andrew's, Glen Waverley. So that's probably back in the late 70s, I think, quite a while ago. My background, I'm 73. I've got four children and eight grandchildren. I was born in India. I'm Anglo-Indian, if you want to put it into that perspective. And we left India and arrived in Australia on the 15th of August 1947. So we arrived the day India became independent. So we left on British passports and we arrived in Australia on British passports. We came on the HMAS Manura, which some of you might recall was a coastal trading ship which went to Europe as a troop carrier, and on its way back, Arthur Corwell made an announcement that he'd helped the Brits escape India, and this ship would be available. From what I can sort of understand, most of the people that wanted to go to the UK weren't keen on going on a troop ship anywhere, let alone Australia. So a number of Anglo-Indians came out when the White Australia policy was in place. So there was a whole furor that went on in the press at that time, and you can follow that if you want to. So we arrived in Australia in 1947. And to backtrack on that, we went to St Philip's Cottesloe, which is an Anglican church. As soon as we arrived, my parents attended the church on a regular basis, and we went with them. So my background and upbringing is in an Anglican background, where my parents attended first St Philip's Cottesloe, and then when they built a house in Applecross, which is where we were brought up, we also attended St George's Applecross, which Mum did until she passed away a couple of years back. So that's my background, brought up in an Anglican household. When I was 16, I met Yvonne when I was 15. We've been married 51 years now, and we met at school, we met at church. We had a whole lot of overlapping links, and we were married at St David's Applecross, which is the new church in that sense, 50 years old now. Our children were baptised there as well, so our links are into the Anglican church system. For those of you that remember Billy Graham and his crusades around that sort of era, Yvonne and I went to Billy Graham crusade. We both made our commitments in that sense at the crusade. We didn't have a conversion experience in that sense. We both felt that we were already part of the church and actively involved, but we did go forward at the end of the Billy Graham crusade in the late 50s, and I think he came from Perth across to the east, and I think filled the football ground here at that time. Our membership is still at St Barnabas, and I make it clear that while we're members there, the way that I organise, around about October, I tell them what I'll be able to do the following year. So this year, I said, we'll be here at St Barnabas on the odd months and the second Sunday. So that means that I'm able to plan the year and make myself available to speak wherever I'm called to speak. And when I'm at St Barnabas, we go to both services in the morning and I make myself available to do whatever they want me to do. So that's as much as or as little as they want, but we've given them, in October, we've given them advice that we're going to be available, both of us available, during that particular month, the second Sunday of the odd months. What we've done, I worked 31 years with Telstra. I finished up as National Product Manager, if you understand that terminology, marketing. I was National Product Manager for different network products, which included, at different times, STD, which you can still understand as a term, ISD, IDD, International. I managed international calls. I managed local calls as a product as well. And I finished up as National Service Performance Manager for Network Services. In 1994, I approached Telstra and asked them if I could leave. Around about March or April, I went to see them and I said I wanted to leave the day after I turned 53, for no significant reason. So I had my birthday on the Sunday, turned 53. On the Monday, I went and kissed everyone goodbye, and then I left. And in order to do something voluntarily within the church background, I thought initially within my own church, St Barnabas. So that's the way that worked. In the meantime, and that's the link to Barbara Darling, before I was married, I did a year. I was selected for ordination in Perth, and I did a year, and then we decided to withdraw. Yvonne and I decided to withdraw. We were married, and I didn't go on with it until 1980, when we came here and I re-enrolled at Ridley, and Barbara was my first Wednesday lecturer. Bishop John Wilson wasn't a bishop at the time. He was my first lecturer on Tuesdays. So I completed in 1980, 81, 82, I did three nights a week. And in 1983, I took a year off on half pay and I finished a Diploma of Theology and Diploma of Ministry. So more recently, just over 2 years ago now, Barbara Darling organised a licence for me. Mainly because a couple of churches, the first church I rang that year booked me at All Saints St Kilda, and then he said, oh, by the way, you do have a licence, don't you? And I didn't, and hadn't had for years, and I said no, and he said, oh, well, you can come and talk, but you won't be able to preach. So I immediately rang the diocese and said, can we set something in train to get this fixed? It took 7 months and 1 day to get a licence. By then I'd already spoken at All Saints and he said, oh, don't worry about it. And the other one was at Essendon, the same thing, and I'd just got the licence and I said, I've got a licence, and he said, oh, you know, who cares sort of thing. So anyway, I've got a licence from the Archbishop as a lay pastoral minister, which gives me some sort of credibility outside the Anglican system as much as within it. So does that link that up? So I've been 20 years now since I retired, and for the last 18 years, I've been working with asylum seekers. It's a way of expressing things, I guess. But when I left Telstra, at St Andrews, I'd been chairman of Vestry for a number of years under Philip Saunders. I'd headed up the Education Commission. We'd led the youth group for 12 years. I headed up a geographic family cluster group, which is a precursor to what people are calling something different now, but we divided the parish into geographic areas and we had responsibility for that area and people came to meetings weekly. So I was up to my eyeballs in that. And even I'd made it clear with Telstra that I wasn't committed to working any more than what I was doing. So if they wanted to promote me, it was on the basis of what I was doing, not what they thought I might do in terms of hours. So I was committed to controlling what I did at Telstra, and I did get promoted several times. I was promoted twice while I was in Theological College, incidentally, which is quite interesting. I got a promotion. Before I went there, I got a promotion to international, and then I found I could complete my study that year. So I went to my boss, who was a non-Christian, and withdrew. And he said, no, I trust you, you wouldn't have tried to put it over. I know you're studying, I know what you're saying. You could find a replacement temporarily, so I did. And while I was there, the replacement rang me at college and said the STD job, which was a step up, has been advertised. I applied for that. And the day of my last exam, my new boss rang and said, congratulations, so you've got the job. Do you want to talk about it? And it was on the morning, and we had an afternoon 2 o'clock exam. And I said, there's a short answer to that, mate. It was Michael Reinberger. I said, the answer's no, I don't want to talk about it. I'll see you on Monday. It was Friday. It was the last day. I said, I've been gone for 8.5 months. And so I went in on the Monday. So that's the sequence of things. That why did I leave? I thought it was an opportune time to do it. It wasn't a calling in the sense of I knew what I was going to do, but I felt there was another way of doing things rather than being up to my eyeballs in administrative things within the church. And I thought if I freed everything up, including work, I could then find a new model that may or may not work, and I was prepared to put that to the test. So for 2 years I tried to get voluntary work within the church. It was during the setting up of St Barnabas, so I helped now Bishop John Harrow, who was our vicar, in his role as archdeacon. I don't know if you'll tune into this, but there's a certain amount of tension in parishes when they're amalgamating, and you know, people from one parish are seen as competitors to people from another. And I thought, well, I just don't want to go up that path, so I didn't compete for anything. But there was, as he became archdeacon, no one was helping the archdeacon because he wasn't an archdeacon last week, so I offered to help him. And we came up with a term at my suggestion, project officer. The first time I signed something, I asked him what to sign it as, and he gave me something. I said, look, I'll have to ask you next week, it'll be another topic, so let's invent a term that's generic. Project officer, it covers absolutely everything. So I used to sign project officer for the archdeacon, and whatever I did carried that weight, whatever weight that carried. So I was able to do that for a while. I worked one day a week at World Vision voluntarily, which gave me links. And I did some other things outside that. So after 2 years of sort of running up and down on the spot in a sense, I got an offer of a position in Balaclava, where Jeff Richardson had opened up a position for a networker, a cross-cultural networker in the deanery. And it was a paid position. And I thought, well, I'll take that. And it was a one-year thing, and I thought that'll open up some contacts and see what happens. So that turned into a three-year contract, which was extended by Southern Region. It was part-time. It was two-thirds time. And I can still recall what happened. They said I was part-time parish administrator, which meant I had to organise my own pay. So I thought, two-thirds of what? And then no one knew. They knew they were going to pay me two-thirds of something. That was a stipend of a curate. But the actual time wasn't clear. So I said, well, two-thirds of six is four, and I won't come on Thursday. Now, that's to establish that churches actually try to squeeze the last drop out of everyone. And they say two-thirds, but they mean, you know, 150%. So I said, no, it means two-thirds is two-thirds, so Thursday I won't come, and I didn't. And then after a few days, I approached them and I said, well, I had an advisory committee. I said, I'm prepared to do something voluntarily on my day off. And the advisory committee, two solicitors said, why don't you help asylum seekers? And the actual words were, no one is helping asylum seekers. That was the rest of it. So as a result of that, they sent me an asylum seeker, and I talked to her, found out what she needed, under what conditions she was here, because I had no idea, and then having found out what she needed, she had a work permit in those days. I helped her to learn the computer to do resumes, encouraged her in talking to her to be more verbally sort of confident and aggressive. She went on and did a doctorate at Melbourne University when she became permanent, but she was very quiet. So, and then people started to hear what I was doing and said, well, here's $5, here's a Met card, here's a couple of cans of beans sort of thing. So it just went on from there. So that's the way it started. I just said, I want to do something. And they said, well, why don't you? And I said, okay. So the model really is, and you see from my leaflet, it's got a biblical base to it. It's to find a need and then apply a biblical base to dealing with whatever that need is. It happens to be asylum seekers. If that fell off a cliff tomorrow, I'm sure I'd find something else. And other people have actually heard me talking and said, well, you know, you've encouraged me to think about helping the alcoholics in the local community or the drug addicts or the children that need food before they go to school or whatever. There's a whole heap of a whole heap of stuff in different parishes, different situations that can be addressed from the same model. Well, in Balaclava, Jeff Richardson, who's since moved from Balaclava to Cheltenham to Bunyip and is now at Traralgon, I've spoken in all the churches and I'll be visiting Traralgon later this year and doing three services there. That's a long link. We opened up the... In helping the networking side of the cross-cultural network in the deanery, which had 8 churches and 7 parishes, I did that for some time, 18 months, and then Southern Region took the role on in a geographic way, so it covered the whole of Southern Region under Bishop John Wilson. And as I said, or as I didn't say, it went from 2/3 time to half time in Southern Region. So as the paid work dropped down, I expanded the voluntary work with asylum seekers. And when the paid work stopped because of funding, then I just continued with the asylum seekers in a full-time capacity. So now it takes me all over the place, and it's grown into something fairly substantial. But the model is a completely voluntary model. We don't have any committees. There's no meetings, which makes it really simple. When I spoke at Whitley and Ormond Colleges a couple of weeks back on a Tuesday morning and Tuesday night, both groups asked me, how do you keep going for so long? And I responded, as I do, I have no committee. And they all laugh and think that's a joke. And I said, it's not actually a joke. That's serious. When you don't have a committee, you remove a lot of tension and a lot of time. The model that I've got is that I'm responsible for the decisions and there are no committees. So it can be said that it's autocratic in one sense, but it's very efficient in another. So it's voluntary, no committees, no one gets paid. Everything is given to me and I'm a steward of God's provision if I'm talking to you guys. If I'm talking to a Probus Club on Monday, which I will be, I manage what I'm given. It's a different emphasis, but God provides everything that we need, and my role is to use common sense, which is a gift from God as well, to manage what we're given in the ebbs and flows of donations, because it's not structured with people bringing stuff regularly, and we're unsure about the number of people that might come in and register, although we know at the beginning of next week we've got a little under 300 people coming in. So that's that background. We moved from Balaclava when I was there. I started on the 6th of February 97. I started an office in Dandenong on the 1st of October 99. And when the resource centre opened initially in Footscray, I closed my office in Balaclava and concentrated in Dandenong. That was just simplifying things. So the resource centre opened. I spoke to their class at the Victoria Uni in May 2001. On the 8th of June, that class had a practical outreach which has developed into the resource centre under their lecturer. And so on the 8th of June 2001, they opened. On the 30th of June 2001, I closed the office in Balaclava. And I've been in Dandenong since, the 1st of October 99. In the last 2 years, roughly, after an absence of 10 years with no caseworkers based in Dandenong, caseworkers have turned up in Dandenong. There are now about 150 caseworkers in Dandenong, which is a reflection of the number of asylum seekers who are choosing to settle in Dandenong. So it gives you some idea of a change. For about 8 years, or there were 10 years with no asylum seekers, with no caseworkers in Dandenong. There are now about 150, and they service a wider area than just Greater Dandenong. But Greater Dandenong has about 2,000 asylum seekers, according to the council, which is it'd be a pretty ballpark figure, given the number of caseworkers they've got. So I've got no reason to doubt that. Of those, we see around 300 regularly at the centre. Okay, at the centre, it's pretty simple. I'm there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we leave at 2:30. I'm there every day. I'm there 3 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And on Tuesdays, we organise the food. So I go to food bank and we get the food given to us and get it ready. On Wednesday, we give it to families. There are about 70 families registered, and they have to come in on the Wednesday. On the Thursday, groups of men come in for food once a week, and single men come in once a fortnight. And they're very strict rules. The women have to come on Wednesday, the men have to come on Thursday, and the single men have to come on the right week. If they miss two consecutive visits, they're taken off and there is no way back. And after 6 months, we take them off because that's the limit of what we can do. And we can only handle people in Greater Dandenong and in the wedge, sort of southeast of Greater Dandenong. So that's the working week in the centre. We have volunteers that come in, different volunteers on each of the 3 days. We have different asylum seekers that help out on each of the 3 days, Christian and Muslim. Church and community people help out. And I have also have students that I supervise who can come from any background, and they're doing welfare community development placements. So I think at the moment I've got two Afghan guys, one guy from Bougainville and one guy from Sudan. So there's a couple, and I've just had a phone call on the weekend, or since I've gone on Thursday, asking for another placement from Chisholm. So we've got a mixture of people from different backgrounds. And I've said to people fairly recently, I use the phrase more often, that what we do in the centre is a microcosm of the society, which is Dandenong. Dandenong is... The statistics from the last census are 24.9% of the people in Dandenong are Muslim, the second highest concentration in Australia. Lakemba is the highest, and Perth, Mirrabooka suburb of Perth, 19.7 is the third highest. And then people ask me questions about ghettos and integration and stuff, and I said, well, if you come to Dandenong, you'll see that it works. And the politicians say the same thing. It works in Dandenong. It doesn't work so well in Mirrabooka because people don't like Muslim people in Mirrabooka, and they haven't got over that yet. But in Dandenong it works. You just see people at school, helping in the centre, moving around the shops there, people from all sorts of cultures and religions. And we're in the situation of being a Christian response to the needs. What I haven't covered is... We have a very small room. It's about as big as a small kitchen for food, and we have a slightly bigger room, about four times as big as a free op shop. For food, you have to be registered, and you have to come in under the conditions. For the op shop, which we can handle things up to as big as you can take away in a shopping trolley, that's free to refugees as well. So we see refugees as well as asylum seekers, as well as asylum seekers who finish their 6 months as well in the op shop part of it. And that's all part of what we do, and that's where the volunteers help out as well. So in Dandenong, to give you an example, I've approached the police and asked them if they'd like to drop by when they're doing their patrols, just walk in and say they're friends of mine. And they've done that on a number of occasions. Just walk in into the situation. If I see them, I say, oh, so-and-so, it's a friend of mine. To try and link the community, the mixed community that we see, into a situation where we recognise the police are on our side. They're not opposed to us. We're not opposed to asylum seekers and refugees as well. And as well as that, we try to link schools. I just had an approach from Caulfield Grammar to see if they can come and do placements with me. A number of other schools like Woodley School down the peninsula, they come in and they work in the centre as well. So we're trying to bring people from outside the multicultural side of Dandenong further afield, bring them in so they can be part of a mixed community and experience that while they're doing it. So Woodley's done it for about 5 years now. And Caulfield, as I said, Caulfield Glen Waverley campus has just approached me. So I'm trying to demonstrate a Christian response in an environment where not only Christians volunteer to help, but we can take on anyone that wants to help. If I had a committee, I'm sure that'd create a tension with some people and we'd have to have a vote as to whether we should do it or not. It's a lot simpler when I say we are doing it and that's the end of it. If people don't like that policy, they can choose not to support us. That's pretty simple. Primary thing that we have is that the primary need that we can fulfil is food. So we give away food. We give away 2 green bags of food, roughly, to people when they come in. We actually choose the food. We've got it up sorted into shelves, and then what the guys do, I put out a tray, which is a sample of what they give out, and then they look at the tray and they duplicate that by putting it into IGA shopping baskets, which we've been given by IGA. So when somebody comes in, they say, my name's Bill. They look down the list. If Bill's on the list, they'll give him food and tick him off, or you know, whatever it is. So they get a shopping basket full of food, and we give them 2 green bags when they first start, and they have to bring them back. We never give them any more bags, and they repack the food into those bags. So that's the primary thing. The second thing is we get given lots of stuff in the op shop, including computers. You'll see in the leaflet we've given out nearly 3,000 computers. And we give all that stuff away. It's clothing, crockery, cutlery, Manchester and electrical items. And when I started with a Mayanesh, it was easy. There was one person I could talk to her, I could help her with a computer, talk to her, help her with resumes, etc., etc. And now we have 300 people coming in. It's very busy. So if you're anticipating that I have lots of long conversations with people, the answer is no, I don't. When they come in and register, I have short conversation with them and register them. And then after that, they're really dealing with the volunteers, with the food and with the op shop part. And the records of that are given to me, but I'm there the whole time. I think probably what I haven't covered is one aspect of it, which may answer it, is we have a picture frame, and I don't know if you can see it from there. It says New NIV Bibles, Jesus DVDs and videos, see David. So my way of linking across to what people might, the questions they might ask, is to put this up. And then if they raise the question, we'll give them an NIV Bible. I buy them in bulk from Coorong. And if they want the Jesus DVD, which is Luke's Gospel acted out in English and then dubbed in lots of languages, this one has 32 languages on it. And we've given away 900-odd copies of this. So people ask for the Jesus DVD and they hear the Gospel in their own language. I don't speak any other language. Everyone that comes speaks at least one other language. So they hear the Gospel in their own language. And the reason I say that is because when I left Telstra and I found a replacement for me, it was Gerard, who was French. And he had a breviate. And he, for the 9 months I was away, he worked in my place, in effect. And in the course of talking to him, Gerard said one day that he could remember the day that he made his first decision in English. And I said, well, what do you mean? Because you're doing a master's. And he said, yes, but I used to think in French and then answer in English. And I thought, that means that everyone that doesn't speak English is going to be doing this mental gymnastics of converting into their own language and then coming out with an English response. So that's why I say it's important that they hear the gospel in their own language and then they can make their response in their own language, even if they didn't tell you they're going to do it in English. Just as an example of this, Bentel Hodder, who's also known as Hodder, and her husband Carver came from Iran, and they escaped. He was running he was involved in an underground church. They were closing in on the underground church in Iran. She wasn't a Christian, and they escaped. And when she was coming out on the boat, and this is a common experience, they can't swim, so a common experience is that they're worried. And she was not at peace on the boat. And she experienced a feeling of peace on the boat where she was told everything would be all right. And I'm paraphrasing all this. As a result of that, she has made a Christian commitment. She asked for this Jesus DVD. She then came back and asked for 40 copies for her friends, who incidentally were all involved with Mark Dury at Caulfield, and 25 people were baptised there just recently. She then came back and asked for another 20 copies because she and Carver had approached me about studying at the Melbourne School of Theology and to ask what I thought about the college. But they wanted 20 more because they wanted to give them out at Narrowarren Station. Now, that's quite extraordinary because she was the one asking and she was the one that wasn't the Christian. So by making the material available, the Bibles and discussion and opening up contact with churches, we can do that based on the fact that we're providing material aid. It's not the other way around, if I make it really clear. It's not an evangelical outreach activity in which we provide food. It's we're providing material aid in the context of a Christian commitment, providing the opportunity to open conversations. All the people I see, without exception, are boat people. All the people have come through by boat into detention and they've been released by either the Liberal or Labor government into the community. And they're on Bridging Visa E, which is a no-work bridging visa. They're all given Centrelink. They'll never get Centrelink until they become permanent. They're all given 89%. Of the New Start allowance, which is a Centrelink allowance, but it's the amount that they get, 89% of that amount, is administered by the caseworkers. So that's where there's 150 caseworkers administering that contact on behalf of the government in Dandenong. So 89% of the New Start allowance. So if I was talking at a Probus Club and they say, why do you help them? I said, this group is in the community under government legislation, and they are on 89% of the New Start allowance, which is the lowest allowance on which you're expected to exist. So that's the scenario. All of them, 3 years ago, around 3 years ago, when all the people I saw had come by plane, because every boat person was kept in detention until they were released on a permanent visa. So I never saw an asylum seeker that was a boat person because they were never released until they were permanent. Now they've released thousands of people into the community subject to continuing processing and nothing is happening, basically. To start with, they were processing into permanency, but more recently, for 18 months, I've not had anyone accept or be given permanency. So that's a scenario. So what we're doing is providing some material aid support which helps them to exist and until the government sorts out their permanency. So when the Labor government started to release people into the community, I had 67 people on the books and some of them I'd had on the books for 10 years. So just to give you an example, we had one guy who was 17 years before he saw his wife and daughter. And he's a Christian guy, which is probably one reason why he could cope with all that. But I remember talking to him one day and I said, oh, you're always very happy. And he looked at me and he said, oh, happy on the outside and sad on the inside. And I said, why? He said, I haven't seen my daughter and wife for 15 years. And then he became permanent and was able to get them to join him. So that 67 I knew, and coming back, I guess, to your question a bit earlier, I knew them well. You know, 10 years a long time, most of them quite a few months. So when I started registering people under the new rules, it got to, from 67, it went to 440 very quickly. And that's one advantage of not having a committee. I went home, I can recall going home, and Yvonne can as well. I went home and I said, well, 440, we just can't keep doing it, you know. So what will I do? And that weekend I decided we'd cut back on the 67, just to pick the figure. All 67 had been coming for 6 months at that stage. I said, OK, $50 gift voucher, kissed them goodbye. And they all knew that we were inundated, and they all accepted that, and that left the other 300 and whatever. And then of those, I said, OK, from now on we'll only help you for 6 months. We'll restrict the area. I cut out Wheelers Hill, Boronia, Frankston, cut it back to Dandenong, so that within a short period I'd cut down from 440 to 300 odd. And I can adjust that as the numbers decrease. If they do, I can adjust the geographic area. So now it's taking in the whole of Greater Dandenong, which goes as far as Springvale. And if the numbers decrease at all, which I don't think they will, then I can expand a bit further out. So we're restricted geographically to limit the numbers. I've never paid an interpreter, ever. It's a cost that I thought, well, you know, somebody gives me $10 and it costs $10 for an interpreter, well, that's $10 worth of food somebody doesn't get. So the deal is I've never paid for an interpreter. But what the other day I had a new caseworker come in and she had someone that spoke Arabic. I found this rather interesting and intriguing. She came in and she said, "Now, what do you do?" And I explained, and she said, "Do you have that printed out in Arabic?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, my client only speaks Arabic. You know, you should have it in Arabic." And I thought, "Well, you don't speak Arabic and you're the paid caseworker." So I said, I haven't needed a translator interpreter for the last 17 years, but, you know, paid person or paperwork. But I went into the room where I had an Afghan guy who speaks Arabic, I had a guy who speaks Farsi, and I got both of them to come out and sort of to cover one another and go through the rules in English, converting it into Farsi and then into Arabic so these people understood. And interestingly, when we'd finished doing all this, the guy spoke to me in fairly fluent English. So I thought, it takes you 10 seconds to figure this out. You're the caseworker and you've come here and you want me to write it out in Arabic. And anyway, so that we resolved the question by doing that. Before I did that, before I had the people on site that could do that, I could walk out, and I have done it. I've walked out into the street and just waited till I saw someone that looked like they might come from the background and just say, "Would you mind helping me to interpret?" There's a cigarette shop just downstairs from us, and I used to use him to translate into Farsi quite often. There's a travel agent just up the passage who said he'd help me with Tamil and Sinhala. There's another wholesaler up the parish, up the passage that said, the arcade, that said he'd help me in Arabic. So the resource is there in Dandenong, and I suggest the resource is there in a lot of other places as well to tap in people who are willing to help if you open up opportunity. The Archbishop in Perth asked me in for a meeting with Kay Goldsworthy, who you might know from here, from years back, the first woman bishop. And he was thinking of duplicating it, and I said, "Look, I don't suggest you duplicate what I'm doing, because at the size it is, it would probably work with a committee more effectively. Otherwise, you've got to have someone prepared to do what I'm doing, which is not a model." I think people have set up similar small things, starting with a model of just volunteering Christian principles and then just talking about it. But, can I just give you two examples and then of that? One example I want to use is this Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea film. Has anyone heard of it? Yep. I'm showing that in the Mount Waverley Justice Group on the 17th of September in St Stephen's. A story, a journalist gone to Indonesia, and she basically talks to refugees, or asylum seekers, I should say, waiting to come to Australia, and asks them how they go about it, why they want to, and then she interviews them later on. Well, actually, you see snapshots of the people, and it says Bill, lost at sea, Jim, still in detention, Phil, in Australia without his family, whatever. So you see these snapshots. This, you probably can't quite make it out there, is a young girl, Zainab, 9-year-old girl, speaks in broken English at the beginning, and she says, why do the Sunni hate the Shia? She said, they bang nails into our heads. It's a 9-year-old girl. They come into come to us and they say, you've left your books behind, and they give you books that are bombs. They come into our school and they shoot the Shia teachers. Good question, isn't it, for a 9-year-old? Then she's 11, 12-year-old, and she's in Dandenong, and they interview her again. She's now in high school. This film was actually shown in her primary school. I figured out from the film where the primary school is, and I went and asked them straight out, was she there? And they said yes, and they've shown this film to the entire primary school. In Perth, when I talked about showing the film in Brighton, at a group called Coalition Assisting Refugees and Detainees, the chairwoman who was there said, we don't allow asylum seekers to do what you're going to do, speak in a public forum. And I said, why? And she said, they're all traumatised and need to be protected. And I said, well, the two people I'm taking to Brighton, one has got a Master's in International Law and the other's got a Bachelor of Economics. I suggest they're both capable of saying no, and they didn't. So why would you stop people from having a say on the basis that you're protecting? I just don't understand it. So we've done the complete reverse here. We give them a voice, we show the film, and I take asylum seekers there with me. So that's an important thing for that particular film. I think I was going to make a comment about where I speak and how it all comes about. 2 weeks ago, I was at St Dunstan's, Camberwell. Last Sunday, I was at St Mark's, Deloraine. Monday, I was at a Rotary Club in Launceston. Friday, I had a meeting with a couple of other people with Greg Hunt in Hastings. Today, I'm here. 3 services at St Stephen's on Sunday. On Monday, I'm in Leongatha at a Probus Club meeting. The following Monday, I'm in Leongatha at a Community Advisory Bureau annual meeting. And on the Sunday, I'm at Emerald Uniting Church. So I'm just, there's a wide sort of interest in the community, in different churches, different organisations. And by speaking and taking asylum seekers with me where I can, we raise awareness and also give people a human face. It's a lot easier to imagine a terrorist and, you know, think what they might be. But when you see a guy that's about 5'6" tall and lighter than I am, and he's got his wife, this particular guy's come to Australia by boat. His wife got a job with the United Nations, signed a disclaimer saying they couldn't necessarily protect her. The Taliban, who'd threatened the guy's wife, then threatened her wife, threatened his life, then threatened her life and physically molested her, like knocked her around. So she's now in Pakistan, in a refugee camp in Pakistan. And he's here, and there's no, under the current legislation, there's no possibility of family reunion. So he's been on our side and has been run out of town. She's been working for the United Nations, has been run out of town, and they're in 2 different countries waiting for a resolution, which doesn't seem to be on the horizon. So that's an example of someone who I've actually asked to come with me on Monday when we go to Leongatha. The meeting we had with Greg Hunt, who's the member for Hastings, and I've met with Greg on a one-on-one basis before, was attended by the local moderator for the Uniting Church, who's like the bishop, a Church of Christ minister, who used to be principal of Tabor College, a doctor who spends a lot of time in Indonesia in East Timor, and Archdeacon Philip Newman, who's locuming down at Mornington, and myself. So if I can just very quickly say that we the doctor actually set the scene by saying, look, we're all coming from a Christian perspective and we're concerned that the government is not demonstrating Christian principles in what it's doing. I'm paraphrasing it. We know that you've come from a Christian perspective, Greg Hunt, and we'd like to talk to you about how you see government policy fitting into what we see as a Christian paradigm. So that was the discussion, and we finished up having a discussion where we each had a submission, 5-minute submission on different aspects, and Greg accepted all that, and he's undertaken to arrange a meeting with Scott Morrison. So undertaken to help us facilitate a meeting, I should say. So I googled Scott Morrison this morning before I came here. He came from a Uniting Church background. He now attends a large Pentecostal church, and he's mentored, according to the article, has been mentored by Brian Houston. That's his background. I find it hard to understand his personal projection of himself and what he's coming, the area from which he comes. My understanding of what the government is saying is that they, under the Howard government, there were no children in detention and no losses of life at sea. I'd accept that as a fact. It's increased to 1,100 people have been drowned, according to Greg, and hundreds of children in detention, and they're trying to deal with that. They see the biggest problem as being the change of legislation that allowed people to use people smugglers to come out here, which resulted in 1,100 deaths. And as Greg said, if you'd gone to someone and said, we've got a policy change that's going to give the benefits you're asking for, lots of people are able to come in, we'll be giving them freedom, and the downside is that 1,100 of them will die on the way, would you, the people proposing that, would you have agreed? I think the answer's probably no. But they're using that the other way around and saying, we want to stop that, stop the boats, stop the risk, and in doing that, eliminate the children in detention. And Scott Morrison is supposed to be right now working on reducing that by 150 right now with the intention of removing the children from detention. So I guess what we were trying to do is say, here's a Christian principle that we don't see in operation. They're saying there is a Christian principle of justice and righteousness, which they see as being implemented by the Stop the Boats policy. So we want to keep the discussion open, I guess, is part of what I'm trying to say.
David, thank you so much for coming along and finding the time for us in your busy schedule. As I said, we have put a bowl just outside the door there by his newsletter if anybody wants to donate something to David and his work as we're going out. And let's give David a round of applause and thank you for coming.
Thank you.